You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We are remembering the NASA mathematician Katherine Johnson, who died this week at age 101. Her calculations for spaceflight passed. They took astronauts to the moon and brought them home again safely. And she defied her era's gender and racial norms. Really an unsung hero for the space agency's early days. So what stands out to you about the female mathematicians at NASA during the 60s? What do you want to know about Katherine Johnson's life? We're at 800-642-1234, talking space travel through the hour. Margot Lee Shetterly wrote the book Hidden Figures that explores the lives of three pioneering African-American women, including mathematician Katherine Johnson. Margot, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on.
How did Katherine Johnson's work, her computations, how did that lay the foundation for what NASA looks like today and its missions?
Well, I think there are two ways. One is that literally before you can walk, before you can run, you have to walk. So Katherine Johnson first started out working on airplanes, like her colleagues at the agency, and they then went on to fly into space beyond our planet. The work that they did flying beyond space, the orbital flight of John Glenn, and then the Apollo missions. Those are really the base for the space programs that we are planning today. So really, the work that she and her colleagues did back then formed a base for us to continue the space program now. I would also say that the work that she and her colleagues did literally changed the face of the space agency and of science, and diversified the workplace and brought talent from all corners, from historically black colleges. White women integrated the workplace from all-female colleges. So what they did was really open the workforce so it looks a lot more like it does today, so that women like me could stand on their shoulders and do the professional work we were meant to do.
We've heard that John Glenn had her check the math on his trajectory orbiting the Earth in 1962. What is it about that story that you find important?
Well, the first thing is that the story's true. You know, it's anyone who's seen the movie, you know, it looks like one of those movie moments, and it has been dramatized in the movie. But it is something that actually happened. During the countdown for John Glenn's flight, you can imagine there are any number of pre-flight checks. They want to make sure everything is right. One of those included making sure that the computer output was right. And in order to do that, they had someone do a hand check. Basically, all of the equations that were programmed into the computer, they had them check those equations by hand. And Katherine Johnson was the person selected to do that because she had been she'd been working very closely with the group that was responsible for trajectory analysis. So as they were counting down and trying to put a pin in the calendar for that day when John Glenn was actually going to take off, that was one of the things that he requested, get the girl to check the numbers. And that girl was Katherine Johnson, and that's what she did. And I think the story has so much power because we're talking about a time in the South when there was still legal segregation, there was still social segregation. We're talking at a time when women, there was still the pervasive idea that women were not good at math, when women weren't able to get a credit card in their own names. They had to get their husband's permission in some cases. And here we have an astronaut, someone on the cusp of becoming one of America's best-known heroes, asking for the right person at the right time to check the numbers. And that person happened to be Katherine Johnson, a black woman in the still segregated South in 1962. And I think that that story really is, it gives us a lot of hope that merit is still possible and that regardless of who you are, where you come from, if you are that talented person, then other people will work hard to put you in the right place to do your job.
We're talking with Margot Shetterly. She's the author of the book Hidden Figures, which chronicles the lives and the work of three pioneering African-American mathematicians, among them Katherine Johnson, who passed away earlier this week. You can join in. Have you seen Hidden Figures or read the book? What do you think about these women? Join in 800-642-1234. So, Margo, while the space agency was ahead of its time in hiring these women, there was still outward segregation. And you documented things like in the cafeteria, there was this sign, colored computers, that was taken down, but designating a table in the back for the women. There were separate bathrooms. What was the workplace like for Katherine Johnson?
Well, the workplace was like many of the other facilities that she had to encounter. She and the rest of the people encountered their lives, like the segregated bus stations, segregated restaurants, segregation in virtually every aspect of their lives. So in that respect, the NASA facilities were consistent with that, segregated work areas. So the irony of their situation was that while the door opened to allow them to come into NASA and to do this work, that was virtually unheard of for any woman, much less a Black woman. They still were subject to these segregated conditions that persisted for, another decade and a half during their time there at NASA Langley.
NASA honored her last year by renaming a building after her, calling it the Katherine Johnson Independent Verification and Validation Facility. What goes on there?
So basically what they do is they provide software support for all of NASA's missions. And I can't think of anything more appropriate than to name this huge computational facility after Katherine Johnson, who provided hand computational support for many of NASA's most iconic and important missions.
Katherine Johnson was the last of the three women you wrote about in Hidden Figures, the other two being Mary Jackson and Dorothy Vaughan. They've all passed now, all three of these women. What should we remember about their legacy, and will we still remember them in the future?
I hope so. And first, I just want to say a note that in the book, although the movie is about the three women, in the book there is a fourth woman, Dr. Christine Darden, who is the next generation, who is younger and who is still very much with us and, talks all the time to kids about STEM. But I think that we will remember them for the work. I want that to be the first thing that we think of, is the actual work. You know, these women were scientists, they were mathematicians, they believed in the mission, they loved their work. So first of all, let us remember them for the work. And then I think we would need to remember them and why everyone has embraced the story is for what they did, what they had brought us symbolically. You know, they've really helped us to shine a light on an entire group and a real class of women of all backgrounds who were doing this work, who provided the support for so many of our major scientific endeavors in the 20th century. So we'll remember them both for the very specific work that they did and for the symbol that they have provided us of what is possible when we bring the best people from any corners of our society to do their best work.
And I understand, Margo, that Katherine Johnson to the end wanted us to go back to the moon.
She was, one of the things that was true about Katherine is that she was always very curious. And from the very beginning, when I started interviewing her, she said, yeah, we've got to go back. We have to see what's out there.
Mm.
And so just always that wonderful curiosity that was one of her defining characteristics was true in every conversation I had with her.
Margo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Biographer Margo Lee Shetterly wrote Hidden Figures, which features the work of Katherine Johnson and her colleagues. The book inspired the 2017 film of the same name. Coming up, we take a look at NASA missions today and the future funding of space travel in the Trump administration. Back in a moment. More space conversation right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about space travel and the future of NASA missions. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. Returning American astronauts to the moon in 2024 remains a top priority for the Trump administration. Vice President Mike Pence spoke to employees at NASA's Langley Research Center in Virginia last week.
I know the men and women in this room are going to play a decisive role when, in 4 years' time, we return American astronauts to the moon and make sure that the next man and the first woman on the moon are Americans.
Should the U.S. be making plans to return to the moon? What other space missions should NASA prioritize? Would you be a space tourist if you could? We're at 800-642-1234. Amy Foster is an associate professor of history at the University of Central Florida. She wrote the book called Integrating Women into the Astronaut Corps, Politics and Logistics at NASA, 1972 to 2004. Amy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start with spending and budget. Like many government projects, spending on NASA has been somewhat contested since the department's beginning many decades ago. Where do we stand currently in budget allocation?
Honestly, we stand currently pretty much at the place that we stood in the 1970s. The peak for NASA funding was in 1966, at which point, you know, we were heavily invested in going to the moon. The Apollo program hadn't yet launched a flight. And so at that point, it represented about 6.5% of the federal budget. By the end of the Apollo program, those numbers had dropped sharply. Even through the development of the shuttle and the current programs, the percentage of the federal budget has actually hovered around 0.5%. Under Obama, it went up to about 0.55%. And that's pretty much where it's staying. So, when I have people ask me, oh, my gosh, this seems like such an expensive endeavor. And when we start looking at number values, of course, we don't make anything like that. We can't even picture what billions of dollars would look like. It does seem like a lot of money. But when we start looking at, you know, the larger representation of what NASA's getting from the federal budget, it's a drop in the bucket. That 0.5%, that's historically been the number for the last 40 years.
What has been the Trump administration's attitude toward NASA?
Well, you know, the one thing that I can say about the space program is it has always been a point of pride for the United States. Even going back to the days of Kennedy, honestly, we went to the moon because, you know, that was something prestigious that the United States could do during the Cold War. And, you know, when we initially were trying to get off the ground during Mercury, we had a number of failures and they were very public and it was embarrassing. And so, you know, what the space program has been about was, you know, bringing hope, bringing those. It was the last place for exploration. It still is. And so it brings a lot of value to kind of that American psyche. And I think President Trump is certainly he's engaged in that, as we have seen with a number of presidents, to include Obama, to include George W. Bush. So there's some consistency here.
Private industry has entered the space race. Space tourism is going to be, you know, anticipate a really big business. What are you seeing in terms of privately funded space exploration, and what is the backstory on it?
So I recently developed a lecture that I gave to a number of teachers in the Cocoa Beach area about this move into private space industry. This was a move that President Obama had proposed in 2011, that he wanted to see greater involvement with private industry and that partnership between NASA and private industry. And as a historian, you know, we're constantly looking for examples of continuity, but also change. And in this situation, this still feels very much like continuity to me. While private enterprise is investing more in their own missions, they're putting up their own satellites, you know, the potential for more space industry or space tourism is there. You know, NASA has been working with contractors since the very beginning of the program in 1958. None of the space vehicles that we've actually launched into space, you know, the capsules themselves or the shuttle orbiter, were built by NASA. they were built by North American Aviation, or they were built by Grumman, or they were built by Lockheed. You know, so these have all that private industry has always been a part of the story that is NASA. What is changing is that these private industries are doing more of their own exploration. So right now, SpaceX is launching from one of the launch pads that was used for the space shuttle. When it's a partnership between NASA and SpaceX, so if SpaceX is sending a capsule up to the International Space Station, which they very soon will be doing with humans, NASA is heavily involved in that. It's an open conversation between what SpaceX is doing back with NASA, because NASA is putting its own gear and its own people at risk.
Right.
And so they need to have a hand in all of that. Now, if SpaceX is launching their own private satellite, that happens largely in the dark for NASA. That's where the divide really happens. But aside from those missions that are strictly SpaceX, those partnerships basically are exactly the same that we've been seeing since the 1950s.
We're talking with Amy Foster. She's a space historian and associate professor at the University of Central Florida. And you can join in. What are your thoughts on the NASA space program? Should we be making plans to return to the moon? What other space exploration should the U.S. focus on? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Amy, last May, President Trump had signed the Space Policy Directive, SPD-2, they called it, really looking at regulatory reforms, oversight by the Commerce Department, and then reviving its Office of Space Commerce. How is Congress doing on oversight and policy in regulating commercial businesses here?
You know, that's always a sticky question. I think the fact of the matter is when we are exploring new technologies, it is the innovators who are pushing those boundaries, and it's the legislation and the regulation that is always retroactive, you know. Mm. And we've certainly seen that with the Internet. As we become more powerful, that technology becomes more powerful, and it's being used for commerce, but also for, you know, cybersecurity issues and criminal activity. That's when, we see the legislation come in. I teach a lot of courses in the history of technology as well. And I think one of the things that's very interesting to me is that process of development. And once society begins to adopt a technology, it's only then that we really start to see the unintended consequences of a technology. We have hopes for it, but we don't anticipate what even the positive consequences are that are unseen, but as well as the negative consequences. And that's typically when we start to see federal regulation come in, is to try to mitigate those negative consequences. And so, I mean, I see this as much as, again, as this is a kind of a consistent historical story, as we're getting as space flight is becoming a technology that is broader in society. So as you know, humans can now pay for a ticket to go up into space. That is where we're starting to see perhaps greater need for regulation, certainly controls on safety. I think that's the really big issue for me as we move more and more into private industry being responsible for space flight. Is I think as Americans, we have to understand that profit is still going to be an underlying motive. SpaceX has deep pockets. Blue Origin has deep pockets. That's a company that's owned by Jeff Bezos of Amazon. Boeing doesn't have those deep pockets.
Could safety be compromised if you don't have the funding and the dollars to back what you're trying to do?
It's a real possibility. I think as Americans, we were shocked by Columbia. We were shocked by Challenger. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be, but the level of safety that NASA, they can take the time to do it because it's part of their directive. But it's also not profit driven. So I think understanding that accidents will happen. Accidents happen, you know, in the automotive industry. Accidents happen in the aircraft industry. And they will happen with more regularity with the space industry.
We're talking with historian Amy Foster. She's our guide as we look to the future of NASA and what it looks like. The Trump administration this month proposed one of the largest budget increases in years as it seeks to return astronauts to the moon by 2024. What kind of experiments do you think astronauts should be doing at the International Space Station? What do you think about cooperation among countries around the world? Do you remember when Sally Ride went into space? Should we return to the moon? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back to talk about NASA, maybe hear from you with Amy Foster right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're looking at the future of American space travel. The Trump administration's budget request would top out at more than $25 billion, with almost $3 billion to develop the vehicles to get astronauts to and from the lunar surface as part of NASA's Artemis program. So Artemis is the agency's top priority. It's a key goal for the Trump administration. What do you think of this renewed focus, this renewed push to get to the moon? What about the cost of a crewed American mission to Mars? What should NASA prioritize? Join in for this space conversation. Your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. University of Central Florida historian Amy Foster is our guide, and she stays with us. So, Amy, let's talk about Artemis. This is a three-phase plan. Can you explain how it will work to get us to the moon by 2024?
Artemis, I love the name. Artemis was the twin sister of Apollo. So they've chosen that name at kind of as a historical homage to those previous program. So, you know, Artemis at many levels is, well, Artemis is a capsule. The Space Launch System, or SLS, is the new rocket that's being designed to get Artemis to the moon. You know, in many ways, it's reminiscent of what we saw with Apollo. I think the name probably implies that. I think that the whole point of going back is there's so little that we did on the moon, you know, and it was almost 50 years ago now that we were there. The last flight to the moon was in 1972. Even the rocks from Apollo 11 in 1969, those are still being studied. Most of the collection has been processed, but there's a lot of work actually still being done on about the last 6% of those rocks. And that doesn't take into any account, you know, the five missions that collected samples after that, that work's being done on those. But, you know, that's 50 years of work that we have that we still haven't even completed. And it was just six missions. There's so much that we can learn about our own solar system, the formation of the universe by studying Mars. I actually have a friend who teaches planetary geology here at UCF, and he tells his incoming freshmen 25% of what I tell you will be wrong by the time you graduate. Science is changing so rapidly.
In mind for your next test.
exactly. You know, and that's science that we think of as hard science. It doesn't change, and it's fact. No, it's, you know, the wonderful thing about science is as we ask more questions and do more experimentation, I like to think about what we understand as science is just simply we can rule out more as wrong. And that's the best we can say, you know, as we move forward, we hope we're getting better answers, but they're better only because we know what to exclude. We've done so little with the moon, and we've done, you know, our extent of what we've done on Mars has only been photographic at many levels. We've only been able to send probes that are sending back data and sending back pictures. You know, the opportunity and curiosity, we're able to do some minor soil sampling, but what we know is minuscule. And I, as good as robotic technology is in going to those, you know, other celestial bodies, the ability for a human to go, wait, that rock shouldn't be there. Why isn't that rock there? We need to understand that better, is invaluable. And so I think still sending humans that are curious and ask questions that they're not programmed to ask is essential to our understanding of the world around us.
So we know our computers are faster than they were in 1972. Technology has changed, but essentially the same basic building blocks of getting people to the moon. How much has changed over the, you know, the past decades?
Right. So, I mean, in terms of rocket development, I mean, the most challenging thing is still motive power. You know, and there's a limit to what chemical fuels can do. There's also a limit to, you know, how, at some level, how big you can build a rocket. And we've understood that for 120 years. Konstantin Tsiolkovsky was a Russian mathematician, taking us back to Katherine Johnson. He was doing work on designing rockets. I mean, he never built one, but he's the one who understood that if you build a rocket that has more than four stages, it now becomes pointless. You're not going to get enough motive power out of those last stages to bother. So if you look at the big rockets that we built, in many ways, they're three stages. And that's kind of the limit of what we can do with chemical fuels. Chemical fuels can only produce so much thrust, but that thrust is still important for getting us off the ground. You know, there are ideas of using plasma rockets and ion rockets, and what those are really powerful for is providing long-term but low-level thrust. So those are capable of moving us from low Earth orbit toward the moon and toward Mars, most likely for Mars. Those are those long-term trips because those engines can stay lit for a very long time and provide that motive power to keep you moving in the right direction. And those have been developed, you know, we've been working on those for some decades now, but getting up off the ground and without development of new chemical fuels, I think what we're going to see certainly for my lifetime, is some consistency with what we've been doing, just simply because of the limits of the technology, as far as we know.
We're talking about NASA with space historian Amy Foster. She's an associate professor at the University of Central Florida. And you can join in this conversation. What do you think about the plans to have humans orbit and eventually land on Mars? NASA now partners with private companies. Is that a good thing? Would you be a space tourist if you could get a seat? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Amy, you mentioned the Russian mathematician. What does cooperation look like on space travel between countries right now, specifically Russia and the U.S.?
Well, to be honest, we wouldn't be going to the International Space Station without the help of the Russians. With the retirement of the shuttle program, all of the American astronauts, all of the astronauts and cosmonauts, as well as astronauts from other countries, the only way they've been getting to the International Space Station is by launching on a Soyuz rocket out of Kazakhstan. So that's been instrumental in us keeping the International Space Station manned, and it has been consistently manned for the last 20 years. It's the only in-space vehicle that has been fully manned for that long. When the Soviets and the Russians had the Mir program, that was never consistently manned. So our partnership with the Russian space program has been essential to keeping ISS going. I'm really proud of that international partnership. You know, it is International Space Station, not just because it's Americans and Russians working together, but we're working with the International Space or the European Space Agency. We're working with the Canadian Space Agency, the Japanese Space Agency. The European Space Agency is a conglomerate of at least a dozen European countries. So the French, the English, the Italians, the Danes, the Swedes, they're all involved. They've contributed components, they've contributed astronauts. And so this really is the a beautiful partnership that's done extraordinary things.
Sounds like it's more, it's all about the science and the global politics can be left aside.
It really can. It's a space for, literally a space in space for science and friendship.
How does the Artemis program fold into our plans to one day get to Mars? How do those two directives and priorities align or not?
Well, our biggest challenge with going to Mars is certainly it's going to take longer to get there. A trip to the moon is 3 days. Trip to Mars is a minimum of 3 months. So anything that we can learn about living on a foreign body is going to be important for our survival on Mars. One of the biggest challenges that NASA scientists and engineers are facing at this point is not so much the getting there and the coming back. We've had some quite viable plans for that for the last 20 years. But it's the survival piece. The biggest concern for NASA and its astronauts is radiation. For being in space for 3 months, how do we field that vehicle to limit the radiation exposure to the astronauts? And then how do we make sure they're safe? And then eating and having air and having enough water on Mars.
The basic essentials. How do you cover
those? Basic. Exactly. You know, so the food, the water, the shelter, and health. And the radiation is a really big concern. NASA has every living astronaut come back to Johnson Space Center on an annual basis for a physical so that they can track the long-term health and health risks of spaceflight. And what we do know is that the risk of cancer is slightly higher for the astronaut corps than it is among the American population. And it's hard to believe that exposure to radiation is part of that. And so that is a real concern. And certainly as we go to the moon, it's going to be spending longer and longer times there. It's not simply just a day or two visit. The plan is, you know, to extend our time there with the idea that we're going to have to spend time on Mars. You know, the shortest duration trip to Mars and back is still 9 months, 3 months there, 3 months on Mars and 3 months back. So that's a long trip. But that's also probably the most expensive. We would love to be able to spend more time there. So how do we keep our astronauts safe and how do we get them home?
There's that safety and cost colliding there once again. Talking about NASA and space travel with the University of Central Florida historian Amy Foster, do you think NASA is prepared to return to the moon? Do you support this mission or would you rather see a focus on Mars? What questions do you have about the future of the agency and the future of the space program? Still time for your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Amy Foster right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. SpaceX is partnering with space tourism company Space Adventures to send people who aren't astronauts higher than we could ever imagine. They plan to offer an orbital cruise on board the SpaceX Dragon. That's the same craft that will shortly take astronauts to and from the International Space Station. Space Adventures expects the flight to take place somewhere between late 2021 and mid-2022. 4 seats available. Are you on board with an orbital cruise? Do you think the space tourism industry will be the big draw in the future? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. And Amy Foster is an associate professor of history at the University of Central Florida, and she stays with us. Let's take a call now. Debbie is joining us from Viroqua. Hi, Debbie.
Hello.
What's on your mind about space travel?
I appreciate the perspective of your guest this morning, and being no disrespect to her. Obviously, she's got a great amount of knowledge and excitement of the history of our space program. But our creator gave us this wonderful planet that we call Earth, and the amount of money that we spend and basically frivolous ideas of going into space on tourism could be better spent protecting and preserving and sustaining the wonderful planet we've got here.
Debbie, thank you for the call. Amy, you know, Debbie is saying this shouldn't be a priority. There are so many other priorities than going to space.
I certainly agree. You know, what we're doing to planet Earth is of great concern to me. One of the things that I can say that NASA's been doing for about the last 40 years is they've got a series of satellites called Landsat, and they monitor planetary conditions. So we're watching changes in deforestation. We're watching changes in global temperatures and rising seawaters. A lot of that is available because of the NASA satellites that have the ability to see the planet from above. The information that those satellites are gathered is sent back to the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration to help shape policy and try to protect the planet as much as possible. So NASA really is, it isn't simply just looking out. It's also looking back. I think there is an emphasis and an understanding among the scientists that work for NASA that, you know, we have to do things right. Not everybody has that same perspective, but I do think NASA does take that responsibility since it is already a part of their mission.
How much can we learn through pictures and images? We remember that the rover on Mars that basically died last year, I think it was. But how much can we take away from images?
I'm not a scientist analyzing those things, but I think we can, you know, one of the things that we can do is we can see visual changes in the landscape. There's actually a rover on the moon right now that the Chinese space program launched that is on the dark side of the moon. And it's taking photographs of a huge lunar crater that exists on the far side of the moon that we can't see. And it's helping to provide information about meteor strikes and the impact that has on the moon, which doesn't have the same environment that that the Earth has. So we have, you know, many meteors that are coming in burn up. Very small meteorites end up landing on the surface of the Earth. But being able to understand the impact of, you know, those meteors on a planet and how that shapes the planet's own ecosystems potentially or the geology of the moon is something that we can use to help understand the bigger picture. So even photographs do provide value, but it also provides a next step for, you know, what areas do we need to focus on when we do send humans or some other vehicle that can gather additional information.
Let's talk about the recruitment of astronauts. NASA has opened its application or will open its application program very soon for the Artemis program. What does it take to be an astronaut today?
So it's changed over time. You know, when NASA was first created, President Eisenhower said that he wanted military test pilots. This was an entirely untested endeavor. And he wanted people that we could trust to, you know, be able to get themselves out of a very dangerous situation. And as a consequence of that, that meant only men could apply because only men were flying aircraft in the military in the 1950s, and only men were qualifying for military test pilot school. We didn't have women going through test pilot school until the 1970s. And the first shuttle pilot and shuttle commander was Eileen Collins. And she was in the second class of women to graduate from the U.S. Air Force pilot training program in 1976, I believe. So, you know, for pilots, the military is still kind of the way to go. You may not have to have that test pilot experience anymore, but you have to have that jet aircraft experience. But when we start to look at the astronaut corps and how it's changed, it's changed radically. And it had a lot to do with the creation of the shuttle program, because the mission profile was changing. It wasn't just simply we need to get into space and we need to get into space first, because it was still about that prestige issue. It became more about science. And so scientists, engineers, and physicians became the focus, the NASA focus. And in 1978, the first class of shuttle astronauts was selected. It was 35 people, 6 women, 3 African-American men, 1 Asian-American man, the rest were white guys. But it was 15 pilots and 20 what we called mission specialists. And they're the ones with the science, technology, and medicine background. What we're seeing now is we also have the inclusion of teachers.
Do they bring?
You know, I recently got to meet Barbara Morgan for the first time. She was Krista McAuliffe's backup for the Teacher in Space program, and she was selected as a professional astronaut in 1998 and flew in 2007. Now, as a mission specialist, not as a as an educator mission specialist, but, you know, she talked about how, again, that ability to handle a situation that you never anticipated was a really good skill. That flexibility, but also, you know, that love for learning. And I think so much about what the space program is about is, again, about that exploration and knowing how to ask questions and finding answers. You know, that as a teacher, that is their job, is to teach us how to do that. Well, they can already do that. And so, you know, giving them the opportunity to explore, I think, is a great opportunity. So we're really seeing who can be an astronaut, a professional astronaut, really changing.
Well, Amy, what, you know, I know historians don't write the future, of course.
No, don't.
You don't write the next chapter. But as you watch NASA evolve and change and a new astronaut program coming in, what are you watching for, and how do you think NASA is going to be changing in the next 4 years?
Well, I think in terms of, you know, who they want, it's still people who can bring a skill. You know, it's you need to be passionate about spaceflight, otherwise you wouldn't do it. Because it's still a risky business. So if you're going to put your, as John Glenn used to say, if you're going to strap yourself into the rocket built by the lowest contractor, you know, you need to have some faith in the technology. And so there's risk involved. But what NASA has always looked for, particularly since the shuttle program, is what skill can you bring to the program? So are you a scientist first? Are you a teacher first? Are you a physician first? Because those are the skills that are going to be applicable in what we're doing and make sending you into space worthwhile. So, I mean, if we start looking at the demographics of, you know, the astronaut corps, we are going to see more minorities. We're going to see more women. Right now, the last two classes of astronauts that have been selected, we've had almost parity between men and women. And that's all about getting kids interested in those fields that NASA's looking for.
Amy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Amy Foster wrote the book Integrating Women into the Astronaut Corps. She's an historian at the University of Central Florida. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This conversation comes to you on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.